This is a presentation by Human Development Outreach and Extension at Cornell University.
Okay, I should say that I actually love to be interrupted. I'm Israeli, which means I come from a culture where you never get a word in edgewise, and I'm totally comfortable if you have more than just clarification questions in the middle of the talk, because I can pick up where I left off pretty easily. And also, I'm very new to outreach and extension. I don't know a lot about it, and I'm so glad that so many people here are involved with work with children, because my deep abiding passion in life has always been young children. Even when I was a very young child, I remember knowing that this is what I was going to do with my life. So I hope that I can learn something from all of you. And also, I'm developing an article on my research for extension purposes. So for me, I'm hoping opportunistically to use this as a bit of a brainstorming session for discussion about real-world implications and practical advice that you see that connects to this very, very scientific, as you'll see very soon, very scientific-based experimental research, laboratory research that I do. Okay. So, my work is with the very youngest children, children under the age of 5. In other words, children who are not yet ready by our cultural standards for formal education, by most cultural standards. But even though these children have not been formally educated, although there's a lot of preschool in our culture too, it's still not the same as kindergarten. And knowing I have a brand new kindergartner this year, so I can attest to that. It's another world. Now, by the time children are 5, though, they've learned quite a lot about the world already. They know a lot before they enter school. And all of this learning happens informally or in the context of play and interaction with parents and preschool teachers, hey, caregivers. So they know a lot about the physical world. Here's a young child, one of my favorite children in the world, age 2.5, exploring both solid and liquid objects in the form of bubbles and a bubble wand, learning about physical causality. And here's another one of my favorite children, also at about the same age, at a science museum exhibit playing with magnetic cars, making magnets move cars around in the display. They also have learned quite a lot about the biological world, both the world of biological entities. Here this child, again, feeding a goat a piece of lettuce. So here's an animal and a plant, two different biological categories that she already knows about, plus biological processes about needing nutrition, digestion, growth. Very importantly, children at this age know an overwhelming amount about the social world. In fact, this little boy here is stretching his mouth really big. He's sitting on top of a lion. And if you ask the girl in the pink jacket, what is he doing? She wouldn't say, oh, he's stretching, and maybe he's hurt his muscles. She wouldn't give a biological explanation. She'd say, Ryan is pretending to be a lion. She knows in this context that his mouth is moving in a pretend action because he's sitting on top of this lion and he's wanting to be one. So the past 30 or 40 years of developmental research, laboratory-based experimental studies with young children of the type that I do, has shown us how much children know at these young ages. And in terms of outreach and extension, 0 to 3 campaigns and preschool campaigns that have tried to encourage people to look and marvel at their young children's knowledge at these ages. So we know a lot about what children know. We also know that this knowledge changes across those years. So in other words, a 1-year-old's concept of solid and liquid objects is not the same as a 3-year-old's concept of solid and liquid objects in terms of the richness and the coherence of that concept. The same thing with the social world. A 2-year-old's understanding of pretending is not a 5 or 6-year-old's understanding of pretending. So knowledge is rich, and yet it changes. They learn. So we know a lot about what children know. However, less is known about how children learn. So this is what I do. This is the question that my research program asks. How do young children acquire this knowledge without formal training? All right. So I'm going to insert a little math in here. Not too much math, but basically I want to convince you and hopefully inspire you that the same way that children's knowledge of the world at these young ages is quite sensible, quite coherent, supports rich explanations, predictions, and actions and interactions in the world, so is the learning process itself quite sensible. In fact, the best way to characterize children's learning, in my opinion, is as a rational learning process. So what does that mean? What's rational learning? Well, rational learning actually has a statistical definition. In the field of statistics, rationality is the ability to use statistical evidence to learn. So children like statistical models, use statistical evidence to learn, and also like rational learning models. This involves their beliefs and their knowledge about the world. So this is the process that I want to demonstrate today with some examples, that children's beliefs influence how they interpret evidence. That's very sensible. And moreover, that this evidence then can serve to change their beliefs. Now, this is a process that's ongoing, and the examples that I'll show you today from my research are simply examples of a much larger, broader research program involving many, many people, characterizing children's learning in this way. Okay, so an outline. I'm going to give a very quick example of this process that I think illustrates it quite well in the physical world, the world of physical beliefs. So this is going to be an example from my early days as a graduate student when I worked on children's understanding of physical causality and their belief in contact causality, no action at a distance. And then my main talk is going to be about my current interest, which is in the way that social context and social information influences how children learn. And I think this is where the usefulness of what I do can come in, which is that children learn in a social context and they learn about the social world from statistical evidence. And I'm going to show you that today. And then I'm hoping that you guys can help me brainstorm the implications that you see for yourselves at the end. Okay. All right, so here's my little example. I won't spend a lot of time on this one, but it is a quite nice illustration of what I mean here. So here's a toy, and this is a toy that I have lived intimately with for the past 10 years of my life. It's a little box, and it's plugged into a wall socket, and it has a hidden switch that the experimenter can control from under the table. And basically, any time I flick the switch, the toy lights up and plays Pop by the Sailor Man, which is actually a song that nobody knows anymore. So the nice thing about this toy is I can put an object on top of the toy at the same time as pressing the switch, the hidden switch, and it looks like the object made the toy go. This is a causal illusion that fools even the oldest grown-ups. And in fact, grown-ups are no more or less fooled than this by four-year-old children. So using this toy, I can manipulate the kind of evidence that children see, and then I can see what they learn. So in this particular study, the first thing we wanted to do is we wanted to find out, remember, beliefs influence the way children interpret evidence. So we wanted to find out in this brand new toy that they've never seen before, but it has some of the properties of toys that they're familiar with, things that light up, things that have buttons, et cetera, et cetera. What are their prior beliefs? What do they think makes this toy go? So we simply give them an object, a wooden block, and we say, can you make the toy go? With no training, with no nothing, and this is 3- and 4-year-old children. And what do? Well, they do a lot of things. But an overwhelming majority of them make contact between the object that you just gave them and the toy in some way. So some of them will hit it quite hard. Some of them will place it on the surface quite shyly. Some of them will touch the side of the box. But all of them try to make it go with contact. So this is just a group of children, 32 children who did this, and 76% of them tried contact. I think only one child tried to use the block as a remote control, and the other children, so they know about remote controls, right, but that's not how they think this works with no training. The other children simply were too shy to try anything. So really, this is quite a whopping majority. Basically, anybody who attempted the toy made contact. So Based on this very simple little pilot study, we assessed their prior beliefs about this toy involved no action at a distance. And we know that children do believe in contact causality from the time they're very, very young. Okay. So here's my model again, my framework. So this is the belief that they have. And then the question is, what happens when we present them with evidence? Can they change their belief? So what I'm hoping to show you is this rational process. And what do I mean by rational? Again, the type of evidence that they get should interact with their beliefs. So in part one here, we're going to show a group of children some overwhelming evidence that their beliefs are wrong, false. We take a block and we use it as a remote control. We hover it over the top of the toy, and we do this twice. And both times, the toy lights up and plays Popeye the Sailor Man. Then we take another block, and we place the block on top of the toy in line with their expectations, and nothing happens. And we do this twice. So now they're getting 100% certain evidence that their beliefs are false, right? That's one group. Then there's this other group. Now here, we give them evidence that their beliefs are false, but we give them probabilistic evidence that their beliefs are false, uncertain evidence. Now, for this group, the remote control object works more often. The contacting object also works, but works less often. And if you ask the children, you do this over and over again, you ask four-year-olds, which one works best? Every single kid says, oh, the red one works best. So they know that they know it's working better. They're tracking the probabilities. And if anybody cares about children's probabilistic learning, I've done studies on that showing that if you don't violate their expectations, you just show them objects contacting the toy. One of them works 66% of the time. One of them works 33% of the time. And you ask the children which one works best, or can you make it go, or which one has more of the special stuff inside, or any of a number of questions. They go with the object that works more often. So we're quite sensible about probabilities. That's not the problem. The problem is here, they have this belief, right? And you're violating their belief, but you're either doing so in an uncertain way or in a certain way. I hope this all makes sense. Okay, so what happens when you give them a brand new object and you say, can you make the toy go? So remember what they do if you've never given them any training or any evidence. They all make contact between the object and the toy. So this is simply a graph showing the percentage of children that perform this on action, the one kid that did try some kind of remote control action. In fact, it's not clear that that's what that kid was doing, but we were trying to be conservative in the coding, so we said, okay, maybe he's not just being shy, but he's really trying to make it go from a distance, and then the whole bunch of kids who didn't want to try it at all. If you give them certain evidence that they are wrong, they will change their behavior. Now, this is a new object. The object doesn't look anything like the objects that they saw before. It's simply the action that they're attending to here. However, if you give them kind of probabilistic, uncertain evidence, a significant number of children will change their behavior. They'll act as if this is a remote control device. But, as you can see, a lot of them hold on to their prior beliefs. So now this difference is not significant, but this shift is. So they've learned. But sensibly, I think, they've learned not quite as strongly as this group. So this is a bit of a toy example, but I think it illustrates the rationality underlying the learning, which is that children can change an existing belief. They can do so based on statistical evidence, but the degree of uncertainty matters. Okay. I felt like I had to present the process in full because the newest work that I'm working on, the paper that you guys read and the other study that I'll describe today, is still ongoing. And I feel like it's not quite as packaged as that last story was. But what turns out is, I'm going to give you my conclusions first, I always do, in the social world, children's rational learning occurs in the same exact way. So here is, again, one of my two favorite children, watching her friend. What is she doing? Children at this age, she's, I think, probably 15 or 18 months in this picture. Children at this age are astute observers of people, as you all know, as you probably teach your parents. They're watching you more than they're listening to you. And children learn a lot from human actions. Now, this might seem kind of funny, but social context has always been studied separately from cognitive development. That's not necessarily true in this department, but it has been true traditionally in the field of cognitive development. Children are asked to do a categorization task or a sorting task or a reading or writing task. Often, the social context of even the laboratory setting with an experimenter is completely left out of the picture. It's sort of controlled for in a way. Well, I'd like to break those boundaries a little bit in my work. I don't think that social context is something that needs to be controlled for. In fact, I think that that's where the meat of all learning at this age occurs, is learning from people, learning within a social context. So, it might seem funny, but I'm going to describe to you rational learning in a social context and hopefully convince you that it's occurring. So, in this case, the social context is children's developing theory of mind, children's developing social cognition. They're understanding that other people's actions are motivated by beliefs, desires, intentions, preferences, goals. And even 3- and 4-year-old children know something about social cognition. In fact, they know quite a lot. And there's a lot of research on this, and I'm happy to talk extensively about it. One of my mentors, Henry Wellman, is one of the founders of this research. So in rational learning, of course, there is statistical evidence, there are these beliefs, and there is an interaction. So I'd like to describe this interaction to you in two studies. The first study, this is the paper that I gave you guys to read, I wasn't sure what to give you, so there it is. I'm going to call it the knowledge study, which is simply how children's knowing about knowing influences their learning from statistical evidence. And the second study is the preferences study. So this is the more exciting end here, the learning end, where statistical evidence can actually teach children something new. And in this case, they're going to learn about what somebody likes. Okay, conclusions again. This is the interaction. Children evaluate evidence, statistical evidence, in light of their developing social knowledge. And children learn about people from statistical information in a rational way. Okay. I'm not sure how many of you took a look at this paper, but basically, when I was first thinking about this, I thought, well, I've done causal learning for a long time, and I have this little toy that lights up and plays music. And as I said, we've always left those boundaries between the social information and the causal information separately. So now, I want to break those boundaries down. I want to see if children's causal learning of a physical causal relation on this toy is influenced by social information. Now, we know that children, again, know a lot about the social world, about the world of people. In fact, 3- and 4-year-old children know that some people know more than other people. They also know that some situations allow people to demonstrate knowledge and some don't. For example, if I can't see anything, I can't tell you what color the microphone is in front of me. And 3- and 4-year-olds know that. There's also a really interesting new line of research in word learning showing that children pay attention to social context in learning words. In fact, over all other kinds of information, social information is key for learning words. If you think about it, we couldn't learn language without a culture, without social interaction, without parents and daycare providers and siblings to talk to us, right? So it's not a surprise that children pay attention to social information in word learning. It might, however, be a surprise that social information is important in causal learning, in learning about the properties of this little mechanical device. For children can very well explore this device on their own. In fact, they can have ideas about this device even without any training, as I showed you. So do they really use social information? And can they do so in a sophisticated way, the way they do when they learn language? Here's my toy, a little drawing of it. We introduced children to two puppets. One puppet If you read the paper, I think it says in there, they're a squirrel and a monkey, and we counterbalance which puppet is the knowing puppet and which puppet is the not knowing puppet. But one puppet, puppet one, knows all about the toy. He's played with this toy before. He knows which blocks make it go. Puppet two, he's never seen my toy before. He doesn't know anything about it. He does not know which blocks make it go. Then we each puppet gets a block, and in 1 second I'm going to tell you how the puppets get their blocks. But once they have their blocks, the actions on the toy are always the same. Both puppets simultaneously put their blocks on the toy, and the toy lights up, and it does so twice. So here's the statistical evidence, right? Block A and block B simultaneously light up the toy. It's completely confounded. There's no statistical way to learn here. Children must, we force them to recruit social information in this task. Can they do it? Okay. I should say that these are average age 4-0. In other words, 3 and 4-year-olds. And in none of my studies are there age differences between 3 and 4-year-olds. I do recognize a huge developmental shift between ages 3 and 4, and I'm happy to talk about that. I have ideas about how to investigate that more. And I know that you guys, if you work with young children, have seen it. They're not the same. In fact, I'm sort of counting the days till my 3-year-old turns 4 so that I can explain to her why mommy has to go to work every day. All right, so here's how the puppets get their blocks. There are 3 groups of children. So this is between subjects, as we say. In group 1, I say, okay, you know, squirrel's going to pick a block and monkey's going to pick a block. And each puppet picks a block from a pile on the table. So now, if children are reasoning about knowledge in this condition, they should say, well, the guy who knows, he might be able to make the right choice here. The guy who doesn't know is probably choosing at random because he doesn't know. And then we contrast this with another group of kids where we say, can you pick 2 blocks out of this bag? And I give them a little cloth bag, and they take 2 blocks. I said, can you give 1 to squirrel? Can you give 1 to monkey? So when the child picks the blocks for the knowledgeable puppet, he can't demonstrate his knowledge. He's constrained. Right? He still has knowledge, but it's not doing him any good. And here's another situation where it doesn't do him any good. We blindfold him, poor guy. We blindfold them both, and we say, can you pick blocks? And they each pick a block. We're blindfolding the puppets. Now, we can talk also, I know some of you are probably already going, but they're puppets. We can talk about the use of puppets in experiment cognitive development research. I'm actually moving towards using real people rather than puppets, but I will tell you with 3 and 4-year-olds, it makes no difference. There's been study after study after study showing that they're perfectly willing to give you the benefit of the doubt, and you'll see from the data, right? So here we go. Now in 1 condition, the green one, the puppets pick condition, we predict that when we ask the child which block makes the toy go, that they now can unconfound the evidence based on the social information. One guy picked based on knowledge, the other guy picked with ignorance. And indeed, that's what they do. And of course, the critical test here is whether they're just doing this because you tagged one guy as knowledgeable and you tagged one guy as ignorant. And so they just say, knowledge good, ignorant bad, I'm done. That's how I know. In fact, that is not the case, because in both the child picks and the blindfolded condition, the children choose at chance. And that's sensible given the fact that the actions are confounded. There's really no way of knowing which block it was. All right, so to summarize, the last little italicized piece of the last paragraph of the paper where I just say that this is showing that children can recruit their understanding of both knowledge possession, having knowledge, and knowledge use, demonstrating knowledge, in interpreting confounded statistical evidence. Hopefully, that seems quite rational. All right, so that's part 1 of my conclusions. How about part 2? Can children actually use social information to learn something new in a rational way? Yeah.
I might have missed this, but did you just tell the children that one puppet knew and the other didn't have any prior knowledge, or did you illustrate it in some way?
No, just told them.
Just told them.
Yes, and in fact, that's only one way to establish knowledge. Often in the word learning studies, knowledge is established not by verbal report, but by evidence.
Right.
So the child will see a person going, chair, computer, another person going, computer, chair.
And lo and behold, the person who labels things correctly, when the child sees an object they've never seen before and that person says, Blicket, they say, oh, well, it must be a Blicket. This guy knows what he's talking about. That actually only works with four-year-olds. Three-year-olds are less good at that. They can do this.
This is where we get into the limitations on the age differences. Three-year-olds, if you give them the social information, then they don't necessarily have to process it themselves. I think that just makes it easier for them. What I did in this study was try to get an effect. I wanted to see how young and how broadly this effect was available. And then the next step, of course, is to see in what ways the ages differ in terms of how much social information they can recruit and how they can learn the social information to begin with. So there's all kinds of stuff to do there. Yeah, that's a good question. So children evaluate evidence and social knowledge, and now children, I said I could be interrupted, so here we go. What's the test of my ability to be interrupted? In the preferences study, I'm going to show you children learning something new. There's two pieces of knowledge here that children have to recruit. So remember, on the side of beliefs, I'm calling them beliefs, but I use beliefs and knowledge interchangeably. Often there are people out there, not people like us, but scientists, who don't want to give children any knowledge, who simply want to say that children have beliefs. I think that's ridiculous. I think we can certainly call it knowledge. In fact, in my world, you can even call it theories. But children have theories about the social world. But all that aside, it doesn't matter. All that matters is that here, on the knowledge side, they have some assumptions about statistics that they're going to be recruiting in this experiment, and also social knowledge. On the statistical side, the evidence is going to come from statistical sampling, which I'm going to show you in a second, and the learning will be learning about what somebody prefers, somebody likes. So they're going to learn something social, and they're going to do it in a rational way from statistical evidence. So this is statistical sampling. Cast your mind back to your undergraduate days, where you learned that a random sample is representative of a population. Now, did you have to learn that? Actually, 8-month-olds know that. They know it intuitively. They're not going to be able to tell you. But if you draw a sample at random from a covered box, and the sample comes out red, 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 white, even 8 and 11-month-old infants, and certainly 3 and 4-year-old children, this has been done in both age groups, expect that the sample came from this box over here and not that box over there. You can do it in the reverse, too. You can show them the box, and you can show them two samples. So you can show them a box of mostly red balls with some white balls, and they'll expect the sample to be red, 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 white, and not white, 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 red. It's quite rational and beautiful. So that's one assumption that they're going to be recruiting in this experiment. That when a person selects at random, in other words, eyes closed, rummaging through a box, the infants and preschoolers expect samples to be representative of populations. And here's the piece of social information that they're going to recruit in this experiment. So here, it's the understanding that actions are intentional. Human actions, not ones that occur with eyes closed, rummaging through a box. But if you saw this, for example, even a 12-month-old infant interprets that action as she wanted to get the mouse. Well, they might not know what a mouse is, but she wanted to get that thing. And in fact, if I did that over and over again until the infant got bored, and then I went out and picked up this thing, the infant would be surprised again. Hey, she wants something new this time. So they don't just think that actions are goal-directed, they think that actions are object-directed. Okay? So intentional actions are motivated by goals for 12-month-old infants, and by the time children are 18 months, they include desires in this too. Not only did she have a goal of getting that mouse, but she wanted that mouse. And if you know what toddlers are like in their own little worlds, this is the age at which their own desires start to appear in full force. So that all occurs together. That's the kind of social information that they're going to be using. Before I talk about preferences, I want to distinguish preferences from desires. So this is really, a preference is really more than just a desire. It's a desire for one thing over all other things or over some other things. So if you and I had a long-standing date with scones, and there was nothing here to eat but scones, so the fruit wasn't available, there was nothing but scones. We came into this inn once a year, and we had scones, and we were all very happy. You might say that we wanted scones. You couldn't say that we preferred scones to fruit, however, unless there was fruit available, and we consistently chose the scones. So that's preference. Preference is choosing something over something else. And you can see, I hope, how sampling might be useful information for preference. When sampling is done by an intentional act, now my eyes are open, and I'm looking in that box of red balls with some white balls, and I pull out white ball after white ball after white ball. All of a sudden, you've learned something about me. She is bypassing all of those red balls and going straight for the white ones. So, let me just skip here. An intentional action with a non-representative sample indicates that a person might be choosing items selectively and therefore expressing a preference. Now, here's the control, right? The intentional action with a representative sample, if I chose red, 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 and white, or red, 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 and red even, that's a random sample, statistically. So I might like red balls better, but you're not really getting information from the sampling in that situation. Does this make sense? Okay. So it's extraordinary, I think, to think that children might actually be paying attention to the sample and population relationship when learning what somebody prefers. We wanted to find out whether this was the case. So we simply introduced children to a puppet. It's the easiest way to do this. When I was a one-woman show, I had to use a puppet. I didn't have anyone else to help me. This is my friend Squirrel. He really wants to play with some toys today. In all conditions in this experiment, Squirrel gets a sample of five of the same kind of toy. In fact, we do this with two different sets of items, so they see Squirrel picking a sample of five twice, and each time the items are completely different. The items in the box are different, and the sample is different. I can talk about what the items are if anybody cares, but they're just simply little knick-knack kind of toys that children have never seen before. They all look exactly the same. What varies is what's in the box. So one group of children has a box with nothing but that kind of toy in it. So here's what I mean by absolutely no information from sampling. The sample is the same. Maybe you like green circles, but preferring green circles, it's like saying I prefer scones when there's no fruit, right? Here, you can see preference, right? If I choose five green circles here, I'm bypassing those little triangles, so therefore I might be preferring circles over triangles. But still, a box that's sort of 50-50, this is no longer, in fact, statistically it's still a random sample, but at least it's no longer representative. Here, it's not only not representative, but it's no longer a random sample. If I now choose five circles out of a box that's 18% circles, now I'm sampling non-representatively and non-randomly. Okay. Squirrel chooses his items. He then leaves under the table. Oh, Squirrel forgot to put his toys away. Can you help me put them back in the box? And we open up the box again. So children get to see this box. It's opaque, but we let them rummage through it at the beginning so that they can kind of get a sense of what's in there. And then we let them help Squirrel clean up his toys so that they can see it once again at the end. Again, here I'm trying to see what children can do in the best of circumstances, not trying to tax their memories. Because if I do that, I'm going to get age differences between 3- and 4-year-olds. And here I really just want to see whether even 3-year-olds can do this. We then bring out three bowls of objects, a bowl of the circles, a bowl of the triangles, and a bowl of something new. And Squirrel's coming back to play, and I put him back on, and I say, can you give Squirrel the one that he likes? What do they do? All right, so procedure, questions, clarification. So this is one group of children, this is another group of children, and this is another group of children. And we do this, and then we do it again with another set of objects. And this is the average number of times that they give him back the circles, my schematic circles. They're not really circles. So out of two trials, if they do it twice, the average is 2. If they do it 1 out of 2 trials, the average is 1. Okay? So in the 100% condition, that's the condition where the sample and the population are the same. So you're getting no statistical information there. Children, on average, give him the one that he played with before on one trial and give him something else on the other trial. In the 50% condition, sample's not representative, but still, it's technically, statistically random. They actually significantly increase the number of times they give him back the one that he played with before. And of course, the whopping increase occurs here in the 18% condition. So here, most children, when you say, can you give him the ones that he like, give him back the one he played with before on both trials. Okay. So what does this mean? Hopefully, I wish I had a slide there with my little model again. Hopefully this means that this process is rational. They're recruiting statistical information, clearly. We just wanted to do one more check to make sure that they were really recruiting the social information, that the actor sampled intentionally. So this is the control condition. And in fact, this is one of my first pieces of data from Cornell at the Cornell Child Care Center. So I have a lovely research assistant who ran this study. There's two research assistants that ran the study. They used the 50% condition. And the only thing they did differently was that they left Squirrel on the table, and Justine, one of the research assistants who was the experimenter in this case, she selected the five objects for him. So this looks a lot like that child's picks condition. This is just kind of a way of controlling for the fact that if Squirrel is not selecting the objects, again, you shouldn't sensibly, rationally infer that he likes them better, right? No matter what the statistical information is. So they did exactly the same thing I did. Only this time, the sampling is experimenter controlled. And just to show you what happened, this is what happened before. You get this nice little bump each time. And that in this control condition, everything goes back to baseline. So again, now that the social information is gone, there's no information. Yeah?
You make a point of saying that she doesn't know what squirrel likes. She's never met a squirrel before.
Yes, we did that. They know she's met a squirrel before. They say squirrel wants to play with some toys today. I don't know what kind of toys squirrel likes to play with. But that's exactly the same thing that we said in all the other conditions. Squirrel likes some toys, doesn't like other toys. I don't know what he likes. Yeah, so the language is actually exactly the same, too. I'm very excited by this. There now, of course, the big test is to run the 18% condition this way, because one of the things about children is that they are really good at smelling a rat, you know, if it's too coincidental. In fact, we tried with blindfolds. You can't do this experiment with blindfolds. They just think he's peeking. You know, it doesn't make sense. And I think that that's quite rational as well. So, I hope that I will take a little aside and say that I hope that one of the things that you see today is that I really do understand what 3- and 4-year-olds are like. And in fact, I'm not trying to claim anything extraordinary. I'm only trying to bring out their precocity, to show it to the world, to show them what children are paying attention to. In statistics, we call this paying attention to negative evidence. When I teach my seminars, I tell my students, when you tell a child girls wear dresses, you're also giving them negative evidence. In other words, in every positive statement, there is the statements boys don't. If they have a category of girl as separate from the category of boy, that means that that statement, girls wear dresses, contains in it boys don't. And I had a couple students who had these little mind-blowing epiphanies. Oh my God, really? There's that much information in that one little statement? Well, the evidence from studies on children's understanding of gender categories shows, yes, there definitely is. This is a very similar kind of thing. So in the choices that you make on a daily basis that your child is watching you make, they're also seeing the choices you don't make. I hope that in and of it, that speaks for itself in a way. And I'm seeing nods, so I'm assuming that it does. That's one of the reasons I love this study so much. It just pops out. Okay, and again, that little step function that you saw shows the rational, statistically rational aspect of this, which is that the degree of uncertainty matters. The relationship between the sample and population in this case is how I manipulate degree of uncertainty. Okay. So here, I hope to have shown you that children evaluate statistical evidence in light of their developing social knowledge. They learn about people, about a psychological cause, a preference in this case,
from statistical information in a rational way. And I do have my toddler studies, kind of, if we have time at the end, if anyone wants to see a toddler in the same experiment, an 18-month-old going through the motions of this task. And 18-month-olds, we know they know about desires, but we don't think that they know anything about preferences yet. But the amazing thing is that they can learn from this information. So we actually think that this is not just something that 3- and 4-year-olds can do because they know preferences exist, but rather a possible learning account for how children develop a notion of preference in the first place, which is very exciting. And we're now doing this with 12-month-olds as well. And I'm hoping that you are impressed by our beautiful youngsters and that this learning process can contribute in some way to their impressive early knowledge of the world. And that's it. Thank you.
This is my implications. I should put a question mark here. Here's my model again, and I want to see if I can get ideas from you guys about what you think is going on.
Did you want to show us your demonstration? Or?
Do you want to see a toddler?
Yes, we want to see a toddler.
All right, so the difference between the toddler experiment, we'll call them the older infants here, they're 19 to 24-month-olds. So at age 18 months is when they first understand that mommy might like something that I don't like, and I might like something that mommy doesn't like. So we started with this age right after that understanding comes in. And like I said, we're doing this now with 12-month-olds because we really want to see how early they can recruit this information to learn something new about human beings. Of course, with toddlers, we don't use puppets. And I hope that makes sense to you guys. We use humans. The other great thing about using humans is for those of you that have learned anything in your, or teach anything to people about emotion and the way that children read emotional expressions, is that the person comes in this experiment, the very, very well-trained research assistants at the University of Michigan, where I started this research. Oh, wow. Oh, wow. And they're really excited. You'll see them on the video. So in both conditions here, there's two conditions here. Rare condition, 18% like before, and 82% condition. Which is better than the 100% condition for experimental purposes because it controls for novelty of the other object. Because in this case, we cannot ask toddlers to pick between three objects. We ask them to pick either the one that was in the box that they did choose or the one that was in the box that they didn't choose. If they're not getting statistical information, often toddlers will defer to novelty because they reason, well, I would want something new. Maybe you do too. In fact, when my 4-year-old was a pilot subject in the preschool experiment, she's now 6, but she said to me as the things were coming out of the box, why isn't he picking the other one? Hey, what's going on here? So I'm wondering if that sort of internal monologue is happening even in the young children.
And 3 to 0 is a tight number, right?
What happened?
Under 82% is
this. Oh, yeah. No.
You don't mean that.
I meant 31 to 7. It should be 7 to 31, 31 to 7. Okay. Excuse me. We had 100% condition initially, which the results are the same. And I actually will just show you one of the kids going through this experiment in the experimental condition here, the 18% condition. So hopefully you'll see that the emotional expressions are identical across conditions. So if children at this age only use emotion to learn and can't use statistics, they should do the same in both conditions. And of course, you already know what's going to happen here, because I wouldn't be presenting this data. All right, so the experiment is going to be Justin. Hi,
See how excited she
is? Wait a minute.
She's on a timer, and she's doing the exact same thing. So she gets a picture of herself. And then clean up time.
One more.
Routines.
Okay. in his eyes.
They're out of his speech, so he
Hi, man. Sam, I am going to be just what I wanted. Can you give me one? Oh, thank you.
And then he gives her more. The other condition is just another kid doing the exact same thing. This time, in fact, the video I have is from the 100% condition. So the box in that case, I think, only has frogs in it. And the kid, of course, gives the duck. So in the climbing condition, the condition where it's, the statistics are of no use here, children actually often will give the other object to the Confederate. Like in the 18th condition where they say, wow, she must really like frogs. And remember, like, this is what I love, this. There's like emotional information here. Oh, wow, ribbit, ribbit. Oh, frogs, ribbit, ribbit. It's exactly identical. Timing and the time she plays with them and the words and the expression. And she was particularly good at this. I mean, I was, you have to do it exactly the same way for every kid. And this has all been confirmed by blind coders, so. I hope convincing.
This has been a presentation by Human Development Outreach and Extension at Cornell University.